So when we look at Bertolucci's telling of the tale of the Buddha's enlightenment, a lot of things are compressed for the sake of the story, or drama, as they say in Hollywood, I guess. In what we've seen, though, if I try and break it into important elements, we have in the story of the Buddha, as told by Bertolucci, starting with his separation, where he leaves the palace. He has the sights before that, the waking, that's the call, the waking up. There's a separation. He leaves the palace. He undergoes trials and initiation. He literally underwent initiation, although Bertolucci doesn't show this, because he had masters who taught him how to meditate. So he was initiated into the life of a yogi and taught how to meditate. He was adopted by the five recluse wanderers that we saw. Trials, the huge serpent shows up, which otherwise will gobble him up, but turns out to be his friend, right? This is symbolic of trials, but also we could say that the whole ascetic life that he lives is a trial. He becomes emaciated with the vigor of his effort to become emancipated in a path that's the wrong path. Then there's a message. He wakes up, he gets the message about things because the helpers come by. The helpers are the people on the boat who presumably are telling the story about the musical instrument that's drawn too tight or too loose. And he understands the middle path, which is the sort of the opening of his understanding into what he needs to be doing and where his freedom is. So he draws away from asceticism, and then he goes off to attain the goal, and he sits under the Bodhi tree to do that. So the question is, what is he doing there? So when we see the story of the attack of Mara, Mara represents, as we see, as Bertolucci has shown us, Mara is like himself, another aspect of himself. Usually Mara is described as being like a devil-type figure, the personification of all the negative passions that drive people. So that's why the daughters of Mara represent lust. The armies of Mara represent fear. I mean, you can kind of go down the list. The point is, what's happening to the Buddha internally, and not just from the point of view of the story, is he's entered mythic mind, right? Because he's having visionary poetic experiences where everything is symbolic. So he doesn't just see a reflection of his own mind, he sees himself. He doesn't just experience his own desires, he meets the daughters of Mara, right? So this is, he's in the mythic realm. So as external viewers, we're given a story, we're given a myth. But in the actuality of what may have happened for the Buddha when he's going through this process, he's entered the mythic realm. And he goes through this process, and something happens in the process. And mostly what it's about is we see up to the point where he has this presumed conversation with Mara. I mean, I think Bertolucci invents a lot of this stuff, although he does draw on language that's in the scriptures. But he's a great director, so it's all okay, you know. Up to that point where he's actually having a conversation with Mara, he's in the mythic realm completely, and he's having these adventures, if you will, and he's conquering demons. But he doesn't conquer demons by picking up a sword and fighting with them. He conquers all the demons and all the negative passions and everything else with his wisdom. He just looks at it and looks at it and looks at it and says, not real, not real. Not going to affect me. I'm not concerned about this kind of thing. Right? Finally, he's presented with a certain problem by Mara. And he touches the earth. Remember this? He touches the earth. And that's the point at which Mara disappears. So this earth touching is a very famous image in Asia. And usually the earth touching and the weapons turning into flowers are in the same image. But that doesn't mean they're in the same time. Now, if you think about earth touching, there's something very mysterious here. According to all the Buddhist stories, what's happened is the Buddha is calling the earth to witness his right to be sitting where he is as Mara is giving him a hard time. I've always felt that doesn't make any sense, frankly, that there's something mysterious there, that there's nothing that you can rationally or logically understand. And even from a mythological point of view, it's a problem. But if you think about it as magical, if you think about it as his entering in the magical mind, which is physical performance, it's a statement at the level of magical mind to touch the earth. Because up until then, he's been utterly immobile. Now, in the Bertolucci movie, he reaches into the water and pulls Mara up, but there's nothing in traditional Buddhist lore about that happening. He just sits there immobile until he has this last engagement with Mara, which is all of his own negativity, and he overcomes it. And one of the ways he overcomes it is he goes down into the magical mind, which is this performance of touching the earth. Now, traditionally it said he's called the earth to witness. I don't really know what that means. I don't think anybody knows what that means. But he does actually touch the earth. So what he's done here is he's brought all of these minds together. Now, Bertolucci shows him being enlightened at this point because he disappears. That's the way Bertolucci talks about enlightenment. He actually turns into light, doesn't he? Right. But again, there's a foreshortening, because in traditional Buddhist lore, at this particular point, Mara has been vanquished, which is to say the passions have been overcome, or he has gone the transition of integrating the rational, the mythic, and the magical minds. But then three other things happen in the course of the entire evening. First thing that happens is he goes through eight stages of meditation into complete formless meditation. And that's in the first watch of the night, as I say, or the first part of the night. And he saw all of his previous lives. This is, again, according to traditional, right, Buddhist teaching. He saw that he was not just Gautama in this life, that he lived many times in the past. He saw all these lives in the past. Second thing is that he saw the nature of dependent origination or causation. Actually, that's the second and third thing, but I'll foreshorten them. He understood the mechanics of how the universe works, and he understood what arises from what and where cessation is. And through that, he gained the final release, and then he becomes enlightened as the sun rises in the morning. Okay. So it's not merely this integration of the three levels of consciousness that produces enlightenment, but when the three levels are integrated, then something else can happen, and he's illuminated. Then he becomes the Buddha. Now, having done this, you'd say, well, okay, the journey is done. But the traditional myth is that the hero returns. Now, the thing to think about when we're talking about the heroic myth, and Campbell gives us the example of the life of the Buddha as heroic myth. It's one of the reasons that I'm following that line. It's kind of easier to do that than to say follow the Christian line, because we're familiar with it, and that has a lot of cultural and personal meaning that's overlaid onto it. So if we go the Buddhist line, for most of us, that's not there. The heroic myth, from our point of view, is something about the past. It's not really necessarily the myth that makes sense in the 21st century. Bly talks about the goddess and the return of the goddess. Whitmont talks about the return of the goddess. Whitmont talks about the way in which we have to deal with the separation in our own masculine consciousness that he describes as the Apollonian, the Dionysian. So something else is probably at work from the point of view of what is the important myth for 21st century people. We don't really know what it is yet. That's one of the things Whitmont says, one of the things Campbell actually says. We don't know what the myth is that's going to make sense for moderns. We might have some hints, but we don't really know it yet. But the heroic myth was the main myth that was evolving at the time of the Buddha. All right. So the story of, say, Ariadne and Dionysus and Theseus and the Minotaur, although those things took place probably, if they actually took place, centuries before the Buddha lived, they were current in the Buddha's time. Now, the Buddha's time is the time when the heroic myth is really expanding through the world and is the myth that matters. Okay, so his story fits in that way, but it's a story about reintegration, is the way I'm interpreting it. Because what I'm wanting to do, if it hasn't been clear, is to take what we've been learning from Whitmont and Campbell and apply it specifically to this story as a way of understanding the story of the founder of a religion and the ideals of a specific religion. Okay, so having said that, let me jump to a couple quotations in the Campbell book that I think exemplify the point of how this myth became functional and important in the Pan-Asian world. Because one of the things about Buddhism is that Buddhism expanded throughout the entirety of Asia in one form or another. There's no piece of earth east of Iran, not one piece of earth east of Iran that wasn't Buddhist at one time or another and wasn't influenced by Buddhism. It doesn't matter what the current culture is. Historically, Buddhism was in all those places. Right? So it's very important from the point of view of the development of Asian consciousness. If we jump to page 10, if we consider the numerous strange rituals that have been reported from the primitive tribes and great civilizations of the past, so Buddhism would be a great civilization in the past, it becomes apparent that the purpose and actual effect of these, and these means initiation, separation rituals, was to conduct people across those difficult thresholds of transformation that demand a change in the patterns, not only of consciousness, but also of unconscious life. These are the so-called rites of passage. And so this is what I'm saying, is that the Buddha's story represents something that transformed in both his consciousness and his unconsciousness, and therefore became relevant to both the consciousness and the unconsciousness of the peoples of Asia. So after this period of initiation, he says, then follows an interval of more or less extended retirement, during which are enacted rituals designed to introduce the life adventurer to the forms and proper feelings of his new estate, so that when at last the time is ripened for the return to the normal world, the initiate will be as good as reborn. When at last the time is ripened. So the period of time that Shakyamuni is with the ascetics is the period of time that's being talked about here, where he's gone through the separation, the initiation, and now he's in a period of retirement. And that's when he's going through this whole process of starving himself and performing other kinds of asceticism, which was typical in his culture at the time. But then he's going to go beyond this. Okay, on page 16, Campbell writes, the hero, so Shakyamuni is the hero is the man of self-achieved submission. Self-achieved submission. He's conquering himself. That's what he's doing in this process. But submission to what? That precisely is the riddle that today we have to ask ourselves, and that is everywhere the primary virtue and historic deed of the hero to have solved. So Shakyamuni solved the problem for the people, the ancient peoples, through his process of integration, becoming whole, as Jung would say. But Campbell's saying, we don't know what the solution to the riddle is for today. But he's saying, whatever it is, it has something to do with self-achieved submission. He goes on page 19. The hero, therefore, is the man or woman who has been able to battle past his personal and local historical limitations to the generally valid, normal human forms. Such a one's visions, ideas, and inspirations come pristine from the primary springs of human life and thought. Then he goes on. The hero has died as a modern man, whatever modern means. So the Shakyamuni was modern 2,500 years ago. But his internal man, perfected, unspecified, universal man, means human, not just male man, he has been reborn. His second solemn task indeed, therefore, is to return then to us transfigured and teach the lesson he has learned of life renewed. So, again, what Campbell is saying is that the hero has to go beyond his own time and culture in part of this process. So the Buddha rejected the religious forms of ancient India, which were very ritualistic, which were very much tied to caste. Only the priests had the ability to engage in religious life. If you wanted to engage in religious life, you hired them to do something for you. Buddha rejects that. He rejects caste, so he rejects society as a whole, because this is the foundation of society. He put everybody in their complete and proper place. So he becomes another kind of human being in this process. And as Campbell would say, he becomes whole and complete, natural in a certain way, by integrating himself outside of the structure of society, which has fragmented him, even though he's a prince. That's just another role, right? He's been forced into this role, which he's rejected. And the point of all of this is when he returns, there's something important. So finally, I'm going to go back, or go on to page 40 under the section called The World Navel. And I'll read this paragraph as soon as I have something to drink. The effect of the successful adventure of the hero is the unlocking and release again of the flow of life into the body of the world. The miracle of this flow may be represented in physical terms as the circulation of food substance. This is the way it was in the matriarchal time. Dynamically as a streaming of energy, or spiritually as a manifestation of grace. And we would understand the latter from the Christian point of view most clearly. Such varieties of image alternate easily, representing 3 degrees of condensation of the one life force. An abundant harvest is a sign of God's grace. God's grace is the food of the soul. The lightning bolt is a harbinger of fertilizing rain, and at the same time, the manifestation of the released energy of God. Grace, food substance, energy, these pour into the living world, and whenever they fail, life decomposes into death. The point that Campbell's making is that when the hero achieves his goal, the goal has to do by becoming whole with bringing life back into a fragmented and unwholesome world, an unwholesome world. So what does the Buddha do in this story? When he becomes whole, when he becomes enlightened, when he sees the truth of what's happening, he comes back in the world and he teaches how to get free of the confines, the constraints, the strictures of a rigid society. And he doesn't just do it intellectually. He actually transforms his society in the way he does this, because he rejects caste and he says, if you follow me, you too will be free of caste. So he creates the order of nuns and monks, which has no caste distinctions in it at all and is utterly democratic. All decisions are made by consensus, not by authority, okay, by consensus, not by hierarchy, at least in the beginning, not by hierarchy, not based upon who was your father, what family did you come from, what was your occupation, none of that matters. It's a meritocracy, because the people who get the most respect are the people who live the way of the Buddha most fully, whether it's from the point of view of morality or wisdom or whatever the case may be. So respect comes on a meritocratic basis, not on an inherited basis. And this is a complete affront to the society of the times. Not only that, at least by one reading, he reintegrates what existed before the Brahmanic period of the sort of the priestly environment that he grew up in, because he talks about completeness and liberation as a self-achievement by retiring from society. And the people who are wandering around India retired from society on the spiritual quest, the hippies of the ancient day, to as my friend Bob Thurman would say, the hippies of the ancient day, right, were people who were probably connected to the traditions of the matriarchy that existed in India before the Brahmanic period, because they were yogis. And yoga, that kind of meditation, was not really known in the priestly class. It wasn't really practiced. They were interested in ritual, right? The Buddha's way is all about learning self-control through meditation and freeing yourself through that kind of self-control. So what he brings back into the world, and the way he regenerates the world, is through this teaching. And if you actually look at the history of ancient India, there is a way that you can understand the Buddhist path as a regenerative path. It did change things, okay? The reason Indians for centuries were vegetarians was because of Buddhism, okay? The kings who became Buddhists created hospitals, and not just for people, but also for animals, okay? I mean, there were a lot of consequences to the society. So this is an example of this kind of return. Now, if for a little while we shift gears to the West, right, and we think about this same process from the point of view of Christianity, if we understand religion and the origin of religions and what the main religious teachers have done from the point of view of Christianity, we see something very similar, because the whole Mediterranean world was transformed by Christianity. Right? It was transformed by this idea that at the time of death, something happened which was freeing, okay? And it was transformed by a magical process. Remember what I said about the problem with the Reformation was that the conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics, in one way, this is Bateson's analysis, could be understood as, do we accept the Mass as a magical operation, literally true, or do we see it as a symbol of something else? In the Catholic Church, it's literally true that the chalice becomes filled with the blood of Christ, that's really important. When you hold the chalice up, the Spirit descends in the chalice. It's transformed. Because it's magically transformed, it has the power to free you from death. That's the whole point, okay? So the dispensation that's associated with Christianity is freedom from death, whether it's understood as cyclic rebirth or understood in any other way. Remember, this is a pagan society, and they understood death in many different kinds of ways, depending upon what their traditions were, and so on and so forth. So Christ can be understood as doing the same thing. Separation, trials, and initiation, the goal, right? He sees John, he's baptized by the Spirit, he goes off into the wilderness for 40 days, he's tempted by the devil, which is like Mara, he overcomes the temptation, and he returns with his message. And this is independent of all questions about resurrection of Jesus after crucifixion or whatnot. If we just look at it, that part of it, we can read it literally, we can read it mythologically. It's the same story over and over again. So now Campbell would have us ask the question, was that the last time this story was relevant? The Jungians make the point that in the Middle Ages, the chivalric stories, I probably mispronounced that, but anyhow, the stories of the knights of the Round Table, for example, the questing after the Grail, was another version of the same story. Whitman is of the view that the Grail myth is relevant for modern people. Personally, I doubt that very seriously. I think that if we were to follow this religious analysis that these people are offering us, and look at our own culture, our own society, and our own times, I think that the conclusion we would come to is we're not exactly sure what the new myth is, and that's a problem. That myth has sort of been eradicated from our lives. But that might not necessarily be true. So one of the things that I'll be doing in the next set of lectures is talking about, again, about the Buddha and the Buddhist way of integration, because there's something in there for us to understand. And I'll also talk about this question from the Christian point of view. And curiously, I think, I'll bring in the issue of evolution, because most fundamentalist Christians have rejected evolution as anti-Christian, but some Christians have looked at evolution as a myth, if you will, that adds a new dimension to Christianity. People like Teilhard de Chardin would be an example of this, or Thomas Berry, who we'll be reading next week. Okay? Is that cool? Do you get a sense of the way I'm trying to bring all these things together at this point?